Can those of you in the back still hear me? Okay. As you will note from the biographical sketch, which we handed out to you, Brother Roy Ennis has been a very active black brother. He is National Director of CORE, Congress of Racial Equality. He was born in St. Croix, Virgin Islands, and moved to Harlem in 1947. CORE, basically, is a pan-Africanist, black nationalist organization built on the neo-Garvian theme and philosophy. It's concerned with black community control, black economic self-development determination, and the building of black institutions and black communities. Through the channels of his various posts in the CORE organization, Mr. Ennis has made many worthwhile contributions. Important to the CORE ideology has been Mr. Ennis's implementation of an economic program and the establishment of the Harlem Commonwealth Council. It is worthy to note that CORE has gotten involved in the whole issue of school integration and has approached the Southern school crisis as early as 1967 with a solution compatible with its philosophy of institutional control. Ennis proposed community school districts as the most useful and pragmatic solution to the problems of black education. In contrast to the old segregated Southern school systems, blacks would control and operate their schools under a new concept. A proposal for community school districts was submitted by CORE and accepted by the United States Supreme Court in connection with its deliberations involving the case of Swan versus Charlotte, Mecklenburg Board of Education. I think we can go on, and again on the biographical sketch, there's a vast amount of material which you have at your disposal. However, I think the topic on which Mr. Ennis is going to speak this evening should provide you with a good deal of information and understanding of what is really going on the national scene relevant to the issue of black community control. Many of you saw or listened to the program on Channel 12 last evening, Black Journal, and I'm sure Mr. Ennis will have some remarks regarding that program as well. So at this time, I would like to formally introduce you to Brother Roy Ennis.
I don't know who is responsible for this, but I have spoken at many schools, many white schools, with a quota of black students, and hardly ever have I seen so many black students in the audience. I dare say that we have a majority here tonight. It's a good feeling. I mean, at least I hope we're in the same side. And most important, I hope when I'm finished, we're the same side. Who's the organizer of this? Is it your professor here? It's an excellent job. But very seriously, I usually talk to white audiences in white campus, even when they have fairly large black student populations. I sometimes ask at the start of a discussion to get a feel for the audience by asking how many integrationists and how many nationalists are in the house, but I wouldn't do that to embarrass anybody. That was my second best joke. Now, last night, there was a very entertaining show on television. That was a real joke. You have, let me see if I'm correct, 10 black leaders, or allegedly so, I suppose. I'll bet he's black. Black nationalists have great love for children, so we welcome response from the children. Last night should have offered an excellent opportunity for black people in the United States, and white people even, to hear from the horse's mouth, so to say, for the first time in a hell of a long time, the various approaches for solving the problems of black people in this country. Unfortunately, I don't think we achieved that. First of all, the lineup of leaders could be questioned. If you notice, you had a lineup of 10 people, 2 avowed or classical nationalists, and the others all kinds of variation of integrationists. Disparity at the very start. And there was a lack of a desire on the part of many of those there to expose their position and to debate them. We of the nationalist sector, segment of the movement, have been trying to get an honest and brotherly debate on the various approaches to solving problems for black people. Our feeling is that black people should be able to hear from the best advocates on both sides this position, and to be able at the end of this debate to select which direction, which approach they will accept. We have not been successful in that quest, and last night was no different. I tried last night, for instance, to focus the discussion around the issue of schools. Why schools? Because schools could be considered, I suppose, the most critical institution for black people at this time. Secondly, because it can so well crystallize the different approaches. And thirdly, because it is such a clear and present problem. Last night, for instance, we had this discussion just at the time that the Fourth Circuit Court, Judge Haynesworth Court, and it seems as if this time, at least from the point of view of the nationalists, old Haynesworth made a good decision. He held up the school consolidation order of the federal district judge that had ordered the schools in Richmond and the schools in the surrounding counties to consolidate. Now, I will go in a little later in the discussion to point out why that was a good decision to hold up that decision. But unfortunately, this group of leaders were unable to deal with that. In fact, ran away from it. The legitimate question that anyone should ask black leaders is really which way black America. And before we do that, maybe we should take a look at what black America looks like. I think by any count, it is reasonable to assume that we have at least 25 million black people in this country. In fact, I have heard numbers going up as high as 30 million. If we should measure the size of nations in this world, the size of nations, the 120-odd nations in the UN, we will see that any group of people numbering 25 or more million will rank among the larger nations in this world, once you get past the United States and China and India and the Soviet Union. Most of the other nations don't have that many people. When we measure the productivity of black people in the United States using the gross national product, it is reasonable to estimate that black people have a productivity of close to $50 billion. And again, that we should make a measure of the various nations, the economic productivity of the various nations in the United Nations, black folks would probably rank among the top 15 in productivity. Now, those two statistics say to me that black folks have a potential to be more self-sufficient than most of the independent nations, independent sovereign nations of this world. And we need to understand that as we consider the various solutions. Historically, there have been basically two approaches suggested by black leadership for dealing with the problems of black people. Now, we can probably outline all kinds of variations, but basically, we can identify two sets of goals and two sets of aspirations. We go back to the old plantation days, we will see black folks fall in these two categories. Those who have certain privileges on the plantation and are very much concerned with maintaining and possibly improving in those privileges on the plantation. And those with very few privileges who want to get off the plantation. Now, without being insulting to either of these two groups, I suppose we can refer to them as the house and the field niggers. And I use it in the best meaning of the words to describe basically the kinds of labor performed by these two groups. And out of this kind, this form of labor, out of their own interests, their own experience, arise two solutions, two approaches. Now, we need to also recognize that within each of these two general categories, those that we can call the house niggers who want to stay on the plantation, improve conditions there, maintain whatever privileges they have, that there will be some differences of opinion as to how to do that. Some would want to do it more gradually than others. Some would want to do it in a more immediate way. I almost use revolutionary way. A little later on, I will try to show how that difference in methodology of people with the same goals exists to the present day. And I will identify one of these differences, a difference in methodology as as those that propose a revolutionary solution to the goal of staying on the plantation. Now, that dichotomy in the black family that exists back in the plantation continued even after the plantation time, after the end of slavery, and we see the development of two layers of leadership. A leadership whose progenitors were the old house niggers, who had certain privileges, who got certain opportunities for education, and certain kind of some opportunities for economic to get an economic edge because of their position in the plantation. That leadership develops, and that leadership has a kind of a attachment to not the plantation any longer, but to the white society at large. That leadership develops basically an integrationist, assimilationist philosophy. Now, last night in that program, I made what some folks might consider a rather outlandish statement. I pretty much suggested that the assimilationist, integrationist sector of the family, part of the family, were people who, in fact, had a kind of a split personality, a schizophrenia. And that came about in a good part because many of them were, in fact, the products of two families. That many of them were, in fact, half white and half black. And they were not able to resolve that genetic combination within themselves. And that carried over into their ideology. And they had a deep desire to reunite the ends of their family. And more than that, even more destructive, they chose, they made a value judgment between the two parts of their family and chose the one that was most rich, most powerful, the one that seemed most successful, that is the white family. So that we have the development of a leadership of people with this split loyalty, people who have, who it's been stated by one of the nationalist leaders, who hate their mother's blood and choose their fathers. But these people did end up, in fact, as the leaders of black people. At least they were proposing solutions for all of us. These people, of course, I can run a whole list of them, the Frederick Douglasses, the Booker T. Washingtons, the W.E.B. Du Bois, down to the present, the Walter Whites and the Roy Wilkins. Pretty much there is a similarity in a goal. There is a similarity in appearance of these people, and surely in an ideology. And we see a corresponding layer of leadership of people whose progenitors, we can reasonably say, came from the field niggers. And these people can be identified as the Edward Blydens and the Martin Delaneys, and of course, the greatest of all, the nationalist leader, Marcus Garvey. And all the way to the present, to the Malcolm X's and the present layer of leadership among the young nationalists. But a clear path can be plotted from the present going all the way back to the plantation, tracing a continuous history among black folks of two sets of leaders, two sets of goals that they are pursuing. Now, we have been struggling for that period of time and having a conflict between these two sets of goals. We have to just read the literature to see the conflicts that went on between Douglas and Delaney, to see the constructions of Edward Blyden, his criticism of the position of the integrationist leaders, to see the vicious fight, the vicious, almost race, in fact, racist fight that existed between Marcus Garvey and Du Bois, wherein Du Bois will stoop to even referring to Garvey as that ugly little man with intelligent eyes. Even worse than that, part of that integrationist, assimilationist aristocracy used to refer to Garvey as the initials that represented the Garvey's organization was UNIA, which really meant Universal Negro Improvement Association. Of course, all you fire-breathing nationalists in the audience, Negro in those days was a respectable word. In fact, when a guy called himself a Negro back in those days, he was really a militant dude. The word of choice was colored. Consequently, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The assimilationist, integrationist aristocracy used to refer to the UNIA as being the ugliest Negroes in America. Now, we clearly understand what these dudes were talking about. Yeah. Yeah, they were talking about the amount of Africanness in the members of Garvey's organization. They were talking about Garvey's Africanness, you see? Because at that period, black folks, the various members of the black family, used to form organizations, and the organizations used to admit people to membership based on how they passed the light meter test and how they passed the fan in the hair test. You see? A certain number of strands have to fall over the eyes to get in. So that if you look at a cross section of the membership or leadership of, say, Garvey's organization is against the NAACP, you will see a clear difference. You look at the appearance of the members of the Urban League and the NAACP, you will see a difference. In other words, there were grades. There were organizations for quadroons, for mulattoes, for octoroons, and people were very conscious of the percentage of their Europeanoid admixture with their Africanoid genes. So that when those folks call themselves colored, it was very deliberate to describe that condition. So as black folks lined up in organizations according to physiognomy, and of course since this lineup corresponded to ideology and goal, we see clearly two types of black people emerging. We see, if we go back to the period of Frederick Douglass being one of the most militant of the black leaders back in the mid-1900s and late 1900s, a real firebrand, but a man who will say in one of his essays, and you know, you all should look it up, check me out in this, I think it's an essay written in 1884. He was talking about the people sinning against the verity of language to call a man of mixed blood a Negro. He will say that the white man calls the man of mixed blood a Negro not to elevate the Negro. Let's dig the racism implicit in all his statements. Not to elevate as if... to list black folks and other black folks with white admixture together is to elevate the entire race. He says it is an attempt on the part of the white man to throw the mulatto and the quadroon down below an arbitrary color line. And he was, you know, appealing this approach. He was, in fact, identifying himself as clearly different and apart from the rest of his family. And that sort of stuff continued through most of black folks' existence in this country. And I will say it continues to the present. The only difference is that we lie about it nowadays. We do not consciously and overtly talk about the amount of white admixture we have. We just feel it smugly and quietly. Now, I know these are rather bitter things to be saying and cutting statements, but it's the truth. I think it's important that we recognize it if we are to deal with this problem. We need to recognize that in 66, when the big turn towards black power came and we started talking about black is beautiful, that a lot of folks didn't quite mean black, they meant light brown. You know? The old little couplets we used to have in grade school, you know. That's it. If you're white, you're all right. If you're brown, stick around. And if you're black, stand back. Yeah. They're still fairly valid, you know. We have kicked off some of the white values, and we don't exactly accept Western European Anglo-Saxonness as the ultimate. We accept in some combination of it as the ultimate. You see, dudes don't talk publicly about, man, I met that nice brown skinned girl with that long silky stuff. You know, no guy, no serious nationalist can say it anymore publicly.
But he will still pursue the same babe. Privately. Now, it's changing, and it's good, and it's good that we can talk about these things and recognize them and don't hide from them. Because there is a definite correlation between all these things and ideology. There is a definite correlation between these things and goals and aspirations of black folks. You know, if we have leaders who identify themselves with a particular caste within the family, then those leaders are going to pursue the caste goals and aspirations. And that is exactly, I will submit, what has happened to black folks and what has brought about this confusion among us in terms of which way black America. The logic of the nationalist position, the logic of the position of community control, is so compelling that it's difficult to understand how any sane people could choose anything else. In fact, all of history support the position of nationalism and the position of community control. Because all of history will indicate that all successful people move to solve their problems of oppression through the development of a nationalist philosophy. They always raise the question of control of their own destiny. So we must raise the question as to why this comes as a foreign ideology to black folks. The plain fact is it doesn't. It is, in fact, the ideology of the average black man. He doesn't articulate it as such. The average black man doesn't call himself a nationalist or anything else. But if you study his moves, if you give him a choice, you will see more times than not he will choose his own, even with all of the brainwashing in this society, even with all of the cultural destruction that's going on. So that the position of community control is a very natural one. And once we understand the history of the two sets of goals and aspiration, the two kinds of leaders, of course, needless to say, that one of these sets of leaders was endorsed and propagated by the, at least part of the white establishment, it is not difficult to point out that, or even to ask you, you know, I can prove to you that more of you know Frederick Douglass, an assimilationist, integrationist leader, than you know his contemporary, Martin Delaney. And I'm certain that all of you know good old Booker T, you see, of Atlanta Compromise fame, you know. And very few of you know Edward Blyden, a much more brilliant and scholarly man. And I am certain that all of you hold the good Dr. William E.B. Du Bois as one of your patron saints. While it's probably only recently that some of you have gotten any knowledge of the great Marcus Garvey. Now, just to deal with Garvey alone, no one should have any more knowledge of Du Bois than Garvey. It's based on production, based on the number of black folks he had organized. The undisputed champion organizer of black folks. So that there must be a reason why. And the reason is that the white establishment, at least part of it, at least the eastern, northeastern brand, northeastern part of that white elite, accepted and propagated the philosophies and programs and goals of the integrationist assimilationists over those of the nationalist self-determinists. And the same thing is true of the present. We all know that King got much more projection than Malcolm X. That Malcolm got projection only after he was dead and couldn't do anything about it. You see? We see now to the present, see the show last night, where you will have 8 integrationists of all shades, some even bordering on nationalism, allegedly so, or some kind of Du Boisist Pan-Africanism. But basically, in terms of goal, two groups, with two of the people being classical nationalists and the other eight integrationists or assimilationists. And you will see more of this. You will always see the propagation of the programs of the integrationists over those of the nationalists. So that there have been a sighting, and we maybe need to look again to the history of the development of these two kinds of leaders to see why whites will side with one over the other. Now, let me talk very specifically about the position of the nationalists, which is at least the first phase, the immediate goal of community control. Let us deal very specifically with a very real life situation, the one I couldn't deal with last night, schools. Now, the history of community control started in schools, at least this phase of it, in Harlem. Some black folks, ironically enough, were trying to integrate the schools in Harlem. Now, if you folks don't know what Harlem looks like, it looks like if you're from Chicago, South Chicago, wall to wall black. Yeah. And if you're from St. Louis, what's the black part of St. Louis? The east side, you know, wall to wall again. You see? Yet, there were some folks fighting hard, big school boycotts and everything else, trying to force white folks to integrate the schools in Harlem. And the white folks laid it on the line. They said that there's a little bridge going from the solid white section called Queens into the solid black section called Harlem. White folks say that their blood will spill in that bridge before their kids will cross it. Naturally, no white kids cross the bridge. The Board of Education built a brand new school. And you know how they improve black folks' education. They give it a brand new concept name. It was called an intermediate school. Now, if black folks can learn from 1 to 6 and then from 7 to 12. Oh, no, 1 to 6 and then from 7 to 9 and from 10 to 12, right? That didn't work so good for black folks. Cranium too thick, you understand? So they changed that into a different kind of thing, a 4-4-4 kind of school. And, of course, that's going to cause some magic for black folks. It's a fancy new building, fancy new architectural design, no windows. Niggas can't jump out. And this school was built in 127th Street and Madison Avenue. That's like what? I suppose that's like King Drive in Chicago. You know, it's close to the heart. Now, the parents vowed that that school wasn't going to open up unless it was integrated. The Board of Education agreed with them that they're going to integrate the school. The board said that we're going to have 50% Puerto Rican and 50% black. This is always me. I have the problems with Puerto Ricans myself, but those parents hit the ceiling. They weren't going to buy it. If there's one thing they hate, you know, they hate being alone with blacks, they hate being with Puerto Ricans even more. They want some white folks next to them. And Puerto Ricans weren't white enough. Too much Indian. So, the war started. These integrationist parents came and started asking all of the organizations in Harlem to give them a hand. And I was an up-and-coming young chieftain in Corps, very, very ambitious for my boss's job. And they came to me and said, look, you're going to help us, you know, integrate the school, close the school down because they want to integrate. I said, no, I can't do that because at least this part of CORE, at that time, you know, CORE was making this change from integration to nationalism. And I said, this part of CORE is nationalism. It's gone. It's no more integration for us. So I can't help you. If you're talking about controlling that school, we could help you. And these parents, great rhetoricians, they said that we're going to demand both things. They're going to demand integration of the schools and control, too. So I said, integration or control. So I said, all right, as soon as you are ready to say control, as soon as you utter the word, let me know, and I'm there. As it turned out, I stuck one of my guys in anyway. And in one of the negotiations with the Board of Education, my guy raised the ante. He demanded a black principal. Now, the superintendent of the school knew fully well he couldn't integrate that school with any white kids from across that bridge. He knew it. So he jumped at the opportunity to settle this crisis by giving us a black principal. I hate to say this, but this would have been the first black principal in Harlem. You know, all solid black Harlem, 50,000 black kids, no black principals. Very few black teachers. We're not lucky like our poor, de jure segregated brothers down south who've got all black teachers and all black principals and things like that before integration. So we won this great concession, one black principal. Well, the superintendent of school forgot one thing, that the educational establishment in New York City, especially principalships, have been ordained and delegated by God already to other folks. You see? And before he got downtown, the white folks busted his knuckles and withdrew his offer. So instead of the war being off, it was on again because the promise of a black principal was reneged on by the superintendent. Good old John Lindsay, you have heard of him. That's the nigger's best friend since Jack Kennedy, who was the best friend since FDR, and who was the best friend since Lincoln. You know that. And the nigger's best friend, the great white knight, John Lindsay, who most of you folks can vote for if he should ever win that nomination, right or wrong. To tell the truth, after all, he's a liberal, isn't he? And after all, he's a Democrat now. And that means something. Right? A liberal and a Democrat, too? Of course. So John Lindsay, being a very shrewd politician, recognizing that he's got to be more responsive to the various white ethnic votes than black vote. I mean, the fact that black people vote for him something like 75 or 80% means nothing. After all, it's only black votes. He quickly chastised the superintendent and called our demand for a black principal racism. Imagine that one. We were the racists. So the fight went on. And from one escalation of a black principals, we start demanding even more things. We want to control the curriculum. We want to control the entire school. From that point on, CORE raised the ante. Not only did we want to control IS 201, that one in the media school, we start saying, and I think we argued very correctly, that it is foolish to talk about controlling one school. You've got to talk about controlling a system of schools. So that we need to control all the schools in Harlem. We need to have a district, a school district, that will comprise the 50,000 students in Harlem, which would be the third largest school district in the state of New York, which has 800 school districts, most of them very large ones with maybe 1,000 or 2 students in them, as compared with over 50,000 in Harlem. Now, the liberal establishment in New York, led by the mayor, John Lindsay, in order to circumvent this move for a call for community control, call for a school district independent and autonomous of the New York City school district, did not really disagree. He claimed to agree that, not with community control, but he agreed with the principle of black people being more involved in their schools. And he agrees with the fact that black folks should be more involved in the running of their schools. And should be consulted. And all of these lesser statements, until he came up with a brilliant idea called decentralization. It was brilliant because it caught black people off base. Black folks lost sight of the correct approach, which was community control, and accepted decentralization. an experimental decentralized district was set up called Ocean Hill, Bronxville, and one called 201. And we pointed out then that these were fraudulent structures meant to trap black people, that none of them dealt with community control. All of them were subunits of the overall school district of New York. And the black people could not, in fact, manage their education through these structures. But black folks can be fooled easily, especially by liberals, whether they're Republicans or Democrats. And they were fooled, because the people in these areas did accept these decentralized districts. Those fictions were then extended so that now New York City has decentralized the entire school district, and you have now 30 decentralized districts. None of them were really amongst into a hill of beans. None of them really having any control of the education in the area. For instance, contracts are negotiated centrally by the central board so that the old arguments with the teachers' union continue. The contract would be negotiated by people not involved. The union was able to, the mayor, the Board of Education, was able to precipitate all kinds of crises in those districts so that the people end up being more in the battlefield than in the classroom. They end up spending more time fighting than educating. And I am not aware of any thing of excellence really produced by either of these districts. In fact, you'll find that education is in a chaotic state in New York. What's even worse, this bankrupt idea of decentralization has spread, I heard, to Detroit. There is talk of it being implemented in Los Angeles, spread all over the country. We're in unsuspecting black folks. I see black legislators in many states actually proposing decentralization as a solution for black folks. Now, we did not give up. The battle in New York was lost. Black folks were fooled. So we moved south. We went, we figured we'd go into fertile, some new area, find a situation where there's a large enough black population, find an area where there's some pressure on that city or whatever the area is to desegregate and offer a true plan for community control. One of the first attempts that we made was to go to Mobile, Alabama. And Mobile was good because you have clearly and easily definable communities for blacks and whites. You also have a situation of a very well-trained black teaching staff and very experienced black educational administrators. So that we felt that this was an ideal place to test this concept. The gist of the core plan for community control was simply this, that in an area wherein the NAACP is, along with ATW, is pressuring to desegregate using integration as the means, that we will call for a referendum in the black community and let the black people in that community decide whether or not they want to desegregate through integration or whether they want to desegregate through community control. Do they want to throw off the dual school system by creating community school districts wherein there will be only one school system? Now, I do hope that no one's going to ask me when I get through if this is not, in fact, bringing back segregation. I mean, I do hope that we understand that segregation is a way of organizing people in a heterogeneous society, two or more groups existing, wherein the two groups live and operate in different areas, and
the control of the institutions, like schools, in either of those areas will be in the hand of one of those groups only. In the case of blacks and whites going to different schools, but white people controlling the white schools and white people controlling the black schools also. I hope we understand that. You know, the control of institutions and the control of flow of the flow of goods and services in and out that community by a group not indigenous to it is what constitute, in a true sense, segregation. It is not the spatial relationship. It's not because black people are here and white folks are here. It's not because black kids are in one set of schools and white kids in a different set of schools why we have segregation. We have segregation because white folks control the action. White folks regulate curriculum, disperse money, set educational goals, in fact, run the action. And of course, it's important that we recognize how similar in fact, you know, if you look at integration and segregation in a dynamic model, how similar in fact integration and segregation is. Because in integration, you have black folks dispersed so that you do not have a separation of blacks and whites. They operate in the same space. They share the same space. But when we study the social indicators, the institutions, we find that the institutions in an integrated society are just as much controlled by whites as they were in the old segregated society. So from that definition, the control of institutions and the control of the flow of goods and services, we see that integration and segregation ends up the same thing. Absolute and complete white control. And what we're talking about when we say community control, we mean exactly that. We mean the control of the institutions in that particular community be by those indigenous to it. Control of flow of goods and services be by those indigenous to it. So that the socio-economic and the socio-political relationship of people and their institution become the salient features of a definition of segregation or separation or integration and not spatial relationship, not geography. Now, we propose, as I said, that the people in the affected community, the blacks in a particular area that is segregated, should vote to a referendum to determine which of the two approaches to take. Should they take control of their schools themselves, which means that they will have a school district that will be equal and on par with any school district in the state, entitled to all the rights and privileges and obligations of any other school district, or whether they will call for integration, the dispersal of their people into the population of the other. That plan came very close in Mobile, but because of circumstances, the Supreme Court calling up all of the school cases in October of 1970, and with those cases being dealt with all through that year and part of 71, we were unable to move that plan once they were in the Supreme Court. We submitted a brief for community control, and this is very significant. Because with all the talk of black power and nationalism and Pan-Africanism, and black togetherness and all that, with all the talk of people being against integration, the NAACP had its shit together. They put a brief in the Supreme Court, and they had 17 of their friends, 17 other integrationist organizations, submit an amicus brief in support of them. The crackers, of course, had their brief for segregation. Dick Nixon had his brief in for whatever he was making perfectly clear. I wasn't quite clear in there. No. Well, it was against black folks, whatever it was. And CORE had its brief in. But when I went to the Supreme Court Library and I did a little research, I saw a stack of 17 integrationist briefs and one community control brief. All the black nationalists and Pan-Africanists and all that will rap it, but not write it. You see? In fact, when I talk to some of those dudes about the whole school crisis, they say integration is irrelevant. I said, what does that mean? See, because I view integration as a steamroller coming to run me over, and I'm standing in the middle saying it's irrelevant. What it was. Well, it runs me over, you see? Because I don't like something doesn't make it irrelevant. If something can affect a lot of black folks, if something can disperse and aid in the cultural genocide of black folks, it can't be irrelevant. But that was the cop-out of the so-called black power, black nationalist, Pan-Africanist forces. Some other real together, very intellectual brothers dunged in Atlanta. I said, look, the NAACP goes and get its social scientists, its integrationist social scientists, like Dr. Kenneth Clark and those dudes, to buttress their stuff, their brief, with a lot of pseudo-scientific data. You know, but it worked. They had some volume of pseudoscientific data in that 1954 Brown case. You know, was very influential in persuading the court. I said, I want you dudes to do the same thing for us. Why don't you guys put together some of the similar data supporting the position of community control? They told me that some good idea, but they were busy. They were busy structuring institutions of higher learning for black folks. And of course I said, where in the hell are you going to find students to put in these fancy new institutions of higher learning if you totally neglect a generation of black youth from kindergarten to 12 that the NAACP is going to disperse throughout America for racial balance? They couldn't see that point. In any event, that situation went down, the court ruled, and luckily for black folks in this country, I don't know if this is court intention, they did not rule in a way to close off all options. Our greatest fear was that they would rule and outlaw and make illegal all talks of community control. Had the court ruled that racial balance was a constitutional requirement, then we would have been in trouble. All talks of black power, all talks of the maintaining of black culture would have been like whistling Dixie, would have been all been gone. Because black folks then would have had to subject themselves to dispersal and the loss of any chance to aggregate social, political, or economic power. Now, recently another crisis broke, and that's the crisis right in the last couple of months in Richmond, Virginia, where a federal judge of, I suppose, of an integrationist bent has ordered the school district of Richmond to disband, along with the school districts of Henrico and Chesterfield County in Virginia, and reform themselves as one district. Very unusual move. And he is doing this in an attempt to establish some kind of a racial balance. So the question again has been raised. We moved into Richmond, Virginia, and we are there now. We were able to do a very unusual thing. We were able to organize the students of Virginia Union into a core unit to fight the consolidation order and to try to establish a plan for community control in the Richmond community. Now, I'm not being facetious when I said a very unusual thing. I gotta be honest, one of the toughest things to do in this world is to organize black students, any place. Right on. And I have an almost unblemished record of failure trying to do it. You see, I have had long talks and debates of all of the intricacies of nationalism and Marxism and every possible ism you can put your hand on with black students. But I have never been able to translate that into action until Virginia Union. And I felt kind of good because it was an all-black school. So that it seemed as if there was a little hope for us after all. And those students are now in the community in Richmond, organizing, passing out petitions, calling for a referendum to determine for the first time for black people to determine for themselves which of the two goals they will pursue, which of the two approaches to desegregation. Should they desegregate through integration exclusively, or should they desegregate by taking over control for the first time of their own schools? That move is presently on its way. It looks good for us. We are getting very good response in the black community, proving to us the black folks really didn't want integration. It was the only option given to them. What I will hope is that other student groups like yourself can find some way to support the efforts of the students at Virginia Union trying to bring about this great innovation, trying to bring about for the first time a situation wherein black folks can choose for themselves. Let me close by reminding you that no place in this world, at no time in history, have any people really consented to have themselves dispersed and made into a minority perpetually. Thank you.
Mr. Ennis will now entertain questions and will provide you with some answers. Let me tell you that after question and answer period, there will be a reception for Mr. Ennis at the ISR Lounge, and please make sure that you pick up the course outlines on both sides of the lecture.